colonialism's evils are broadly still understood to be something that's happened over there, in this nebulous beyond. And I think that's probably something that really needs to be challenged.
Hello and welcome. This is Queer Recollections. It's a podcast where we're exploring and rethinking queer British history. Following the Black Lives Matter protests in the summer of 2020, the historian David Olusoga, in an interview with Tortoise, said this.
We've created this idea that real British history took place in Britain, and that is the Ireland story. And everything else is ancillary, or it's marginal, or it's an optional extra to have on the curriculum. And that is the fundamental problem, that this history, what we think of as mainstream history, has written the empire and slavery and the stories that make sense of black and brown people and their presence in Britain out of the main narrative.
The same could be said of queer British history, that if we simply stick to an island story, we're neglecting to talk about the effects of the British Empire on queer lives under its jurisdiction and the legacies of homophobia this empire has left behind. To shine more light on this subject, specifically in a South Asian context, is Ibtissam Ahmed, a queer Bangladeshi activist and academic living and working in the UK, whose research centres on utopianism, British colonialism, grassroots activism, and queer identities in South Asia. In the spirit of expanding the remit of queer British history, we talk about the effects of the British Empire and colonialism on queer life, identity, and possibility within South Asia, in this context meaning modern-day India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan, as well as where queer activism in South Asia currently stands.
A lot of this is framed by my own personal journey. I'm from Bangladesh, and growing up, it was and remains illegal to be in a same-gender relationship in Bangladesh. And growing up, I was never really given the context to understand why that was the case. I was just closeted for personal and for security reasons. And I never really understood why that was the case. And it wasn't until I came to the UK that I was in a place where I could be openly gay for the first time in my life. And that led me, that gave me the space to really explore what identity meant for me. And I think it was a very liberating experience, of course, and I'm really grateful for that. But it was also a strange experience to then discover that the reason it was illegal and is illegal for me to be openly gay in Bangladesh is because of a colonial era law from a legacy of British colonialism. So it was a strange experience realizing that the country where I'm finally being able to be open about myself is the country that made it illegal for me to be gay in the first place.
How was gender and sexuality understood in South Asia before British colonization?
Immediately pre-British Raj, I think the safest thing to say is that there was a diversity, both in terms of gender and sexuality expression, but also in terms of the tolerance and intolerance of that. If we look at historical sources from Bengal, which is where Bangladesh is at the moment, you do have books and you do have literature and popular culture that indicates that sexuality was definitely understood to be a spectrum. And if we look at the historical acceptance of various gender identities, like the Hijra community, we know that gender was certainly recognized. But at the same time, there was definitely social stigma around a lot of that as well. You could not get married unless you were a cisgender man and a cisgender woman, which then defined what would constitute a family unit. So there were those limitations that were present even before colonialism, but I think the difference being that it was broad and it was diverse, and there wasn't one accepted approach to it, and there certainly wasn't one legal approach to it, and that's what changed under British colonialism.
What did change with British colonization?
So something that sometimes gets left out in discussions of colonialism is that certainly in the 19th century, there's a lot of Christian morality at the center of colonial lawmaking. And that's really where Section 377, which I keep referring to, that's where that really came from. So Section 377 was implemented in 1860. And what Section 377 was trying to police was acceptable intimacy. It banned carnal desire. And it's important to point out that the actual law never stated a specific identity. It never specifically targeted homosexuality. It never specifically targeted queer folks and or any language that would have been relevant at the time. For instance, it doesn't make any mention of deviance, which is a common term that you'd see in the literature at the time when describing homosexuality. What it did target was any type of sexual intercourse that wasn't aimed at having children. So the idea was that sex for pleasure was immoral. So broadly speaking, Section 377 was actually aimed at challenging any type of sexual intercourse that wasn't, strictly speaking, penis-vagina. And that even meant that under some interpretations, you could technically say that sex with contraception was also in contravention of Section 377. So that's where it started. But because sexuality was so loosely understood across the Raj, it was actually relatively easy to criminalize, because this was the first time sexuality was being used in a legal sense. But gender was harder to criminalize because there were existing gender identities. And I mentioned hijra a few times because that's a very visible identity that still exists. They're a self-defined third gender community, in fact. But using English terminology, they would be classified under the non-binary umbrella. But because those identities already existed, and because the identity wasn't a direct contravention of the act of intercourse in any sense of the word, Section 377 could not be used to criminalize them. So the Criminal Tribes Act was then introduced, which targeted Indigenous communities, which targeted some lower caste communities, but which also targeted several gender diverse communities and classified them as criminal tribes because their behavior and their customs and their culture were antithetical to British colonialism.
Could you explain a little more the difference between the Hijra community and European understanding of transgender?
Though I will very, very quickly add that I myself am cisgender. I'm not Hijra, so none of what I'm saying now is lived experience. So the Hijra community, it's both a gender expression, but also in many ways a cultural identity. They are people who live outside the gender binary, and as I said, legally they're recognized as the third gender. India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan, to various degrees, actually actively recognize them as a third gender on census forms, on official tax forms. Although they are third gender, they do use feminine terminology such as having a den mother. And they do wear saris, which are traditionally understood to be women's clothing. Historically, they were considered to be part and parcel of gender expression and gender identity in South Asia. And they were largely not only accepted, they were almost in some ways celebrated as showcasing how diverse humans could be. Although I do say this from a very Bengali perspective, I don't know if they were viewed quite the same way in other parts of South Asia. And historically, they would also have been protectors of unwanted intersex children, for instance. It was very common for them to bless weddings. What increasingly started happening under colonialism, as their identities became criminalized and as concepts of moral sexuality became more and more normalized, they then began to be viewed as deviant. So they went from being a very self-sustaining community to a community that then had to rely on things like begging and sex work in order to survive. So by the time India and Pakistan became independent in 1947 and Bangladesh later on in 1971, the perception of the Hijra community had changed from being semi-celebrated to understood to being an existing identity, but one that carried a lot of social stigma. There was a lot of misconception overlap between being a sex worker and being a Hijra, for instance. Even though that is certainly they're not the same thing. Going back to the question of LGBTQ plus terminology, yes, you could argue that they fall under the broad trans umbrella if we understand that someone who is trans is someone who is assigned a different gender at birth. But they do make a strong point, and many Bangladeshi activists have done the same, that it is possible to be Hijra and trans, but the trans experience is much bigger because it can be seen as an umbrella term. And there are trans South Asians who are not Hijra as well. So I think that's really where the distinction comes in.
As I understand it, laws against the Hijra community were less successful, perhaps, than laws against same-sex sexual activity, because there weren't equivalent communities of men who had sex with men or communities of women who had sex with women in the same way that there were Hijra communities. I mean, is that a fair thing to say? Or
there are some regional exceptions, but yes, broadly speaking, gender diverse identities had a long-standing historical acceptance. And while, again, that doesn't necessarily mean they didn't face stigma, they didn't face direct erasure. Whereas same gender intimacy, homosexuality, bisexuality, if we use modern terms, pansexuality as well, they wouldn't have been understood as a very specific identity. So in many ways, what happened was, as much as it was a case of legislating them out of existence, it was also very much a case of, well, we're actually giving you the word for these in the first place, which is deviant, and we're telling you from the outset that this behavior is wrong. And there's a very different reaction to that when you have an existing identity and then you're suddenly being told it's criminal, versus, well, this is behavior that we know, but we don't really have a word for it, and here's the first conceptualization, here's the first universal conceptualization of it, and it's wrong.
Do you think that's why colonial understandings of gender and sexuality in particular took hold?
I would say so. And I think a lot of that as well is tied in with the kind of visibility of the two different aspects of identity. So gender expression was a very visible part of identity, whereas intercourse was a very intimate one. So while you would see public examples of gender diversity, whether it be the existence of communities like the Hijra community, but also whether it be things like cross-dressing in theater or mythological literature that talked about characters who change gender, you'd see a lot of public displays, and accessibly public displays of gender variance. But intimacy was a very private thing. It was it is by its very nature an intimate act. And because of that, and because of the growing moral panic around sex generally that occurred under colonialism, that meant that sexuality wasn't able to also very visibly resist. That's in many ways the shape of the rights movement today, is that Gender variance and gender diversity faces a very different type of queerphobia than sexuality does, because gender diversity is understood to be part and parcel of society, but it's still considered less than. Where sexuality is much more of a shameful, private thing. So on the one hand, you have levels of protection because if you're closeted and you're discreet, you don't have to face those same levels of abuse. But it's also considered a lot less acceptable because it's considered completely shameful and not natural.
That's interesting. I'm wondering what was the effect of Section 377 on women who had sex with women or lesbians.
In the case of women, what we saw was that it tied in with broader questions of patriarchy and conservatism and the moral panic of women dressing obscenely. I mean, you see that having an impact on the way women's clothing evolved at the time. For instance, if you see saris in modern usage, you will see that the draped cloth of the sari, there'll usually be a blouse underneath that covers the top. But traditionally, saris didn't have a blouse. That was something that became normalized during colonialism because of the idea that women could seduce men and therefore encourage impure thoughts. And it was something that was normalized under colonialism, but that certainly existed under patriarchal Hindu and Muslim ideology as well. So I don't want to lay the blame on just colonialism. In many ways, what we see in modern South Asia, and I can certainly speak to this from a Bangladeshi perspective, because of the way patriarchy functions and already kind of colors the sexual acceptance of women, the impact of queerphobia has a very different texture between male couples and female couples. A really basic example to use, and this is a modern example, if you are a single woman, it is heavily discouraged for you to live alone. And part of that is social expectation, but part of that is also a security question. And it is still, generally speaking, frowned upon if you live with another unmarried man. But because there's that broader measure of female agency when it comes to questions of sex, two single women living together is perfectly fine and unremarkable. So what we do actually see is, I won't say it's thriving because that's a disservice to the social stigma and the dangers associated with it, but there's certainly a very established lesbian community in South Asia, but it's completely underground because it relies mostly on couples doing care for each other and surviving because two women living together isn't seen as suspicious. On the flip side, two men living together would be, because male sexuality is so much at the forefront of all of these conversations. So for gay men, the type of community building has relied much more on group community building rather than on couples creating spaces for themselves. And what that's basically led to, certainly in Bangladesh, is a lot of visibility for gay men in the rights set, in the rights struggle, in activism, and a lot of erasure for lesbians because they haven't had to rely on the same spaces. So they haven't, in many ways, they haven't been involved in some parts of the struggle, but also in many ways they've been left out of some parts of the struggle because there's that kind of very flippant view of, well, you're safe anyway in your little couple bubble, so don't worry about it. And you know, that's such a huge challenge in modern rights.
You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that we're still living with the legacies of colonization. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering in that context what the status of Section 377 is across South Asia today.
I think something that sometimes that gets erased a lot is that the Commonwealth is the single most homophobic international bloc of countries. 35 out of 54 Commonwealth member states criminalize same-sex activity.
Mm.
And a large part of that is down to the legacy of Section 377. Section 377 was introduced in India, but it was then exported to Australia. And in Australia, the law was tightened so that the punishment went from being a very vague imprisonment to a very specific imprisonment for a certain number of years. And then it came back to India, and then from India, it was then exported again to the African colonies. So while the law may not exist as Section 377 in various parts of the world, it is effectively that same law that continues to criminalize same-sex activity in many parts of the world. And it's a very tricky question in some ways, because of course it's very easy to simply blame colonialism and then not take any responsibility for the fact that these are now independent countries which have embedded queer phobia that needs to be tackled as well. What I think it allows for, though, a recognition of this combined history is, on the one hand, it allows collaboration between activists from what might be seen as very different parts of the world, but actually going, you know what, we have a shared history, we have solidarity that we can build on, and we've seen that happen with groups like the Commonwealth Equality Network and the Kaleidoscope mm-hmm. Trust, which is the latter, which is based in the UK but works with activists globally. On the flip side, what it does, and I think this is what's really important for British listeners and British policymakers to be taking away from this, is that there needs to be a level of humility, I think, from the UK, because the UK prides itself for its LGBTQ plus rights record. It is constantly ranked highly in the European index of LGBTQ plus rights and happiness. But part of that is predicated on having made things unsafe in other parts of the world. Because it's the UK is then able to kind of frame itself as, well, we're better than other parts of the world. But that's down to colonial history. And given the types of queerphobia that already exist in the UK, but on top of that, given things like racism against LGBTQ plus immigrants who live in the UK, not to mention the extremely problematic and invasive way that LGBTQ plus asylum seekers and refugees are, for lack of a better word, are processed in the British system. Those are things that need to be adjusted as well. So not only is it understanding our histories locally and reclaiming those histories and working to use them to empower communities at home, it's understanding that these are histories that are connected globally. And that's something that often gets left out.
Why do you think there's so much ignorance, and I include myself in this, why do you think there's so much ignorance within Britain on the effects of British colonization in general?
There needs to be a reckoning of the fact that colonialism was bad. And I think on a very, very, very fundamental level, that still hasn't happened. There are still many people who cling on to the belief that colonialism was a benevolent force. And I think in many ways, one of the big challenges is that colonialism's evils are broadly still understood to be something that's happened over there, in this nebulous beyond. And I think that's probably something that really needs to be challenged, is there isn't an understanding of, one, it has harmed people within Britain as well. But two, even if it did happen, in a nebulous over there, that does not mean colonialism was good.
I'm wondering, in your opinion, in modern South Asia, how do you think queer liberation relates to decolonization?
I think queer liberation is a really important part of decolonization in South Asia. On a very basic level, there is the fact that queer liberation is actively undoing a colonial era law. So to start with, on a purely term on a purely technical basis, it is active decolonization. But I think what needs to happen is an embedding of a more intersectional understanding of queer liberation within South Asia. And I think an excellent example of this actually is happening in India right now, where some of the lawyers who worked on the case that repealed Section 377 are now trying to look at marriage equality for same-gender couples. But marriage equality in India is a much broader conversation. It doesn't exist for Dalits. It doesn't exist between inter-caste marriage. There's still a lot of violence between people who marry between religions, based from both communities and even from government. There's challenges for disabled people to get married and retain their standard of living, which is quite low to begin with. There's challenges about nationality. There's even challenges based on skin tone, and this is a social challenge more than a legal one. But I think it's important here for the lawyers and the activists to understand that the marriage equality struggle isn't just a queer struggle. It's a broader struggle of equality. It's a broader struggle of justice and equity. And I think that really needs to be the approach from a South Asian perspective, is while it's perfectly understandable and vital that the very specifics of queer struggles aren't erased, the only way for them to be really emancipatory is to then tie them into other struggles and to give solidarity.
Are there problems with following Western models of gaining LGBTQ equality?
I think the challenge is not so much there may be a problem, it's that the Western model is considered the only viable model. Coming from Bangladesh, when I speak to local activists here in the UK, they'll be shocked to hear that we have gender diversity as a legally recognized aspect of identity, because per the trajectory of rights in the West, decriminalization of sexuality happens before decriminalization of gender diversity. And I think what needs to happen is not a rejection of the Western rights model, but an understanding that it is one of multiple models, and that it doesn't work everywhere.
Are you hopeful for the future?
Cautiously, and I do have to say cautiously, largely because we've seen in Bangladesh a rise in violence against LGBTQ plus activists. They lost to leading lights in the community in the past decade. Many others have either had to go into hiding in Bangladesh or have had to flee. Most of us in the community who are able to be vocal are able to do so because we're not in Bangladesh. I think it would be a disservice to all of the activists who do such amazing work to not be hopeful. And I do think that the 2018 judgment in India was a pivotal moment because it showed that despite the right-wing direction of politics in the country, the judiciary is still a very powerful tool, as long as it is allowed to remain independent. And I think that's a very hopeful thing for South Asian countries to be looking at, because politics can be very fickle. But the judicial, if judicial independence is protected, that can be a really powerful direction for rights to take, for civil rights and human rights to take. But I also think it's important for us to be cautious and pragmatic with that hope.
Could you talk about the murder of the two activists, if you don't mind? You don't have to if you don't want to.
I appreciate being given the platform, and I think, again, I'm someone who didn't know them on an extremely deep personal level. They're of course both heroes of mine because of their activism, and they're people who are just known broadly on the community. Zulhas Mannan and Mahbub Rabbi Tonoi were both extremely visible and vocal members of the community. They worked on Bangladesh's as of yet only LGBTQ plus themed publication called Rupban. They organized spaces like the Rainbow Rally. They organized a queer contingent within that march. So it wasn't Pride Parade, it was including queer visibility into an existing Bangladeshi tradition. So for them, it was about saying, well, actually, no, queer identity is part and parcel of Bangladesh, so it should be celebrated. And those were very brave steps because, again, they were putting themselves out there when it was still illegal to be gay, and it still is. That's the amazing work that they did. And they were both brutally murdered in 2016 because of rising Islamist extremism that continues to happen in Bangladesh. What happened was that they were actually targeted not just because they were LGBTQ plus, but because they were challenging the ideal of a very conservative Islamist society that these extremists wanted. These extremists are not people in government, they're not people in power, they're not a political party, they are quite literally terrorists, but they had enough social capital and implicit social support in terms of the people they were targeting that they could get away with it. No one has been charged as of today. And while the government condemned the murder, they did also say, we condemned the murder, but maybe the activists should have been a bit careful about what they said. So effectively saying, well, we're blaming the victims here. And what that message did was it galvanized opponents of LGBTQ plus activism. It galvanized opponents of free speech, of free thought, of secularism, in basically acknowledging that while what we do is not officially sanctioned by the government and by the authorities, it's not something we'll get into trouble for. And in many ways, that the biggest reason why activism has become so discreet now, and those of us who are abroad are able to be vocal because we're not back home.
If you don't mind me asking, is it safe for you to go back to Bangladesh?
It is not. I very recently wrote a coming out essay for a Bangladeshi website. And for people who know me, that came as no surprise, but it was a very conscious decision that I made because my current academic trajectory gives me leave to stay in the UK for a while. I've made something of a life here. I have a loving partner. I have a home. Given those material consideration, I felt it was safer, comparatively speaking, for me to come out. So having taken that step, I don't envision myself going back home anytime in the near future.
That was Ibtissam Ahmed, whose life, work, and activism all assert that we are living with the legacies of colonialism, and the effect on queer people, both historic and present, remains largely unaccounted for and unacknowledged. The British Empire, colonialism, and its effects aren't widely known, nor nor are they taught in British schools in a substantial way. So I hope this conversation is a small corrective to that erasure and is the start of more conversations and discussions on this subject. Until next time, please do rate and subscribe. I've been Will, and this has been Queer Recollections.